Okay. The issues I want to cover today are really addressing the ethical issues that I could come up with that I think are most pertinent in dealing with ADHD in our community. Number one, the responsibilities of parents and principals, schools, parents to children with ADHD. The issue of shidduchim and the whole issue of how candid and how much we can mask in terms of shidduchim, and the ethics of universal full-time based medrash for young adults with ADHD, which we hopefully will have time to get to. Okay, so I first want to talk a little bit about just the criteria of ADHD, that people know what we're talking about. ADHD are children who have issues with inattentiveness, restlessness or fidgetiness, and impulsivity. Okay, their impulse control, they can't wait, they blurt out things, they don't raise their hand, teachers have problems with them, they have problems sustaining attention, organizing things, etc. Okay, these have to do with executive function tasks. Next slide. Basically attributed to dysfunction in the frontal lobe of the brain. And I don't want to get too much into the whole, this whole lecture on understanding what ADHD is and the neurophysiology, etc. But basically, we're talking about forming, planning, and carrying out goal-directed activities. This is where they have problems. The ability to change behaviors depending on the situation, the control, the self-control, the supervisory or cognitive, you know, the supervisory processes of the brains, of our brain, and the higher level organization, okay, in terms of their ability to, you know, focus on things, organize things, the executive functions we call of the brain. It is not, so it's put very well, it is not a disorder of knowing what to do, but of doing what one knows. Okay? Very often, kids get into trouble, not because they don't know what they're supposed to be doing, but they're not doing what they know they should be doing. Okay? The executive functions, right, control our behavior, right, from external events to mental representations related, that I can think about what I'm going to do, I can plan it out, I can, you know, the ability to learn to control myself as opposed to only others controlling me, the ability to delay gratification, the ability to think towards the future and not just now. Okay, so this is what they really struggle with. So as Dennis Menes puts it so well, by the time I think about what I'm going to do, I already did it. Okay, to sum it up. And this is where they get into problems. So we have a responsibility, number one, to educate our children. Number two, in terms of that, there is a difference in the whole article in between U.S. law and Jewish law in terms of whose responsibility. Each state has its own laws about what they're required. We know that in Jewish law, the primary responsibility of chinuch really is on the parent. But for the benefit of those with no father, teachers were retained. This whole Talmud, the Gemara talks about in Bava Basra, about how Yehoshua ben Gamla saved Torah by establishing teachers in each town and starting really at the age of six. Okay, so what are the responsibilities of parents and principals and teachers to our children? Number one, the idea of Chanuch Hanar al pi Darko is that recognizing each child as an individual. Each child has to be treated separately. We know the very famous story of Rav Preda and the Gemara in Eiruvin, that he would learn with his students 400 times in order for his student to understand. The extreme that the Gemara talks about of going to help our students. Right? The teachers, schools, principals have to be willing to provide educational needs of as many students as possible. Okay? And the important thing is not to blame the victim. ADHD children are impaired, as we just showed. In other words, the problem with ADHD is not that, yes, they know what to do and how come you're behaving this way. Well, they're behaving this way because their impulse control is poor. They're behaving this way because their executive function controls are poor. They're not in full control of what they should be doing. So let's look a little bit about Bet HaLacha. Okay? There's a famous Igrish Moshe, and in fact, I have some sheets. You don't have to take notes because I've got, if you want, you could pass these around. We've got some handouts that have a lot of the Jewish source texts. Okay. And the Igros Moshe talks about, you know, what a Rebbe's supposed to be, right? That he talks about Elo Dal Hamora Belimud Torah Olav Liro Shatamid Yeda Belibo Shatamid Yikabel Talimudim Kolkach Ad the Nafsho Shazo Igor Chayin Vizo Tachlis Haimiti Shaladam Baolam Kadesh Iskay Metzel Shmir Sator Bechol Proteha. That the idea of being a teacher of Jewish, you know, a Rebbe to children is that it's not just about giving them information. It's about really transmitting the idea that this is what's really most important, okay? And that this is the, you know, there is, this is the Ikar HaChayim, this is the essence of our lives. In other words, that the Shmir Satorah, they should really accept fully, right? That should be the main thing. And they should not bayis yashu, Sharon Sha'eza Talmud, ain't alone karoi, and if the Talmud isn't learning properly, they shouldn't give up on him, right? Even though he doesn't behave properly, right? As long as he's not being mekalkel other students, he's not being destructive to the other students, you have to keep him and work with him, because maybe he'll start listening and he'll improve. Okay? And don't think, right, that you know, this work is just too hard, right? Because the students don't listen, right? You should know that this is Melechus HaKodesh, and this is what you have to keep working and trying to do. And then this, he says, Sav mitzad chiyuv didei la Hashem Yisbarach, achar shekibol olav ha'misr mechuyuv hu'amol v'fi yichol tabemes. The Rebbe has to accept this and work hard, notwithstanding the fact how difficult it seems to be. Okay? And he mentions the Yuvda Repreta that we just talked about, that he's worked 400 times. The only proviso he says, "Avalei Talmid Makalkel Es Achirim Vaday Tzorich Lasalko Aval Tzorich Lodim Bazev Bekovid Rosh Uvien Rav Kihu Kedine Nefashos." So he says there is one reason you can expel a student, and what is that? Is that if he's Makalkel Achirim, if he's destructive to the other students, but you have to think about this very seriously, because it is like Dine Nefashos, it is capital crime. So, they say that I have ADD. They just don't understand. Oh, look, a butterfly. Just to remind us, okay, that, you know, this is what kids with ADD go through in school all the time. They're trying to pay attention. They want to do the right thing. They're sitting in class, like you're sitting here in the classroom, and they're trying to really listen to pay attention, but then they notice something going on the side. This is, you know, and very often we end up blaming kids when really they're not the ones to blame. Rather, we need to figure out a scenario that works better for them. If you heard Dr. Dave Polkowitz talk earlier, he mentioned Rav Hirsch in this week's Parsha, talking about that if Esav had a different type of school to go to, and wasn't the only option was probably Yeshiva Shem Bever, that he might would have turned out differently, okay? And the world's history would have turned out differently, okay? So we have to identify and properly refer students who have learning behaviors and issues. I can't tell you how many times kids get referred to me in high school for the first time. They haven't been identified, nobody noticed. I can't tell you how many kids who, in other words, there are assumptions that good educators make. So they have two, this past week, I had two kids who came to me, one in elementary school, one already in high school, who are, you know, very anxious, and, you know, they've gone through school, they've mulled through, they're not doing really well, they're having, you know, they have other issues, but the fact is that the anxiety probably was never dealt with till now, and their underlying ADHD, that was clearly evident when I evaluated them, wasn't dealt with either. And very often we'll make assumptions that the kid will be all right, he's doing okay. It's not always okay. We have to train in what ADHD is, how to identify it. We have to train teachers in recognizing, understanding, and helping ADHD students. And unfortunately, educators often have a bias against identifying and diagnosing, because they don't really believe that kids need the medicine. If I'm a really good teacher, the kid's gonna learn from me without it. Okay, so there is a bias in much of the educational system, not all, against it. But we really have to be educated about it, and we have to educate parents. And we need a procedure for informing and talking to parents, because I can't tell you the difference for a kid who gets treated in fifth grade versus a kid who first gets treated in 11th grade. It's really devastating for kids. It destroys kids' self-esteem. They have higher rates of depression and other issues because they feel like they're dumb. Okay, they feel they're bad or something's wrong with them, they're lazy, because they've been told this. Okay, so we want the principals, you know, what you know, the words, can the schools do? Teach kids organization skills, develop, have alternative smaller classrooms, have kids sitting up front. Multisensory Learning is an amazing book that came out years ago by Sandra Reif on how to reach and teach ADD, ADHD children. And I remember I spoke about this years ago when I spoke to the BJE and talked about teaching ADD kids and gave the example of that our model is the Pesach Seder. Okay, it's very multisensory, right? Matzah zushanu ochlim. We point to the matzah. We talked about the matzah. We eat the matzah, right? You look at you have the maror. You have it's multisensory. It's very involved. Okay, and especially in the younger grades, having kids do with, act out, be involved with. I teach all the kids I treat how to study. And they teach them how to study is basically you can't just read it or even read it and highlight it and expect to remember it. You have to do something with it. The more you do with it, the better you'll know it. So that if you read it and highlight it and then you write an outline or you make flashcards, right? By the time you've made the flashcards, you remember it about 150% better, okay, than you did beforehand. Because you're using different parts of your brain, it's keeping you focused, you're doing with it. Just sitting is the worst thing for these kids. And the other thing is exercise, which very unfortunately, a lot of our kids don't get nearly enough of. It's the first thing that we cut out in yeshivas so they should, they should have more time to learn. But the fact is, if anybody read the book, The Spark, that came about that John Rady put out, I think last year, 2 years ago, shows the connection between exercise and brain function and how you increase, cognition, IQ points, etc., by regular exercise. And so, cutting that out is probably not the best idea. In the classroom, the idea of having classroom management skills and creative lesson plans and using each child's strengths, allowing kids to, go into their strengths of drawing or music or whatever it is to help them to really boost their self-esteem and feel special about who they are. Helping children stay organized. I remember, my kids were in fourth grade. My boys, the teacher used to put on the, not only write the homework on the board, but then she wrote on the board a list of what you have to take home today. Okay? Which was so smart. And then I remember other teachers, kids I used to, you complaining about how half the kids aren't taking home what they need and aren't doing their homework properly. Well, if you wrote on the board what they need to take home, they would take it home because it would be organized for them. Because, kids at that age generally aren't organized enough to keep it all together. And certainly in boys, where we're talking about probably close to 10% rate of ADHD, doing what's needed to help them, clear rules, knowing what to expect. Now, with parents, they really have to be involved in your child's education. You have to know what's going on. You have to go to those parent-teacher conferences, talk to the teachers, hear what's happening. You have to be willing to listen when your kid talks to you about it, what's going on in class. You have to be willing to teachers when teachers and principals address their concerns. Very often, parents don't want to hear the complaints that the school has. He's in school, you should be able to help and take care of him. But we really need, you have to be able to get the professionals to evaluate and help. Denial, okay, or what some parents I've seen do, school hopping, because they don't want their kid labeled, and this will come to the whole shidduch issue next. We have a culture where we think if we don't label it, it doesn't exist. See, you're not there anymore. You disappeared because I closed my eyes. And going through life and modeling this approach, unfortunately, is very detrimental, okay? And, has real ethical questions to it, because we're really harming, we're not helping. So we have to really, as parents, we have to listen to what, you know, what teachers are saying. We may interpret in our own way. We may, you know, if the kids had many teachers who didn't have this problem and one teacher has the problem, we may think that maybe it is the teacher's problem. Maybe it's not my child's problem. But we have to at least take things seriously, and we have to listen. Okay. So, boys, too much TV causes attention problems. What was that all about? I don't remember. Oh, just another point to make about ADD. When you talk to eight kids, right, all kids, but especially kids who don't focus that well, it's really important to get their attention before you talk to them. If you try to talk to them when they're watching the game or watching the show on TV, they really don't hear you. Okay. And little things like bells or stuff really distract them very quickly. They don't remember what they're talking about. But as parents, we can't give up until we understand the problem, we get answers. For parents also, getting help for parents, I refer people sometimes to watch Super Nanny, because getting structured in your home is very important, especially from the time your kids are young. Having a schedule, having a routine. Kids love routine. If the kids have a structure and a routine, and they know when they do their homework and when they play, when they get supper and when they go to bed, they tend to do their homework and tend to go to bed on time. If there is no structure, they tend to avoid doing their homework and going to bed when they feel like, which is generally too late and they can't get up in the morning, and so on and so forth. Be a role model for learning. If you want your kids to come home and do their homework and learn and so forth, if we want our kids to learn Torah, then we have to show that we learned Torah. Don't push things off and wait, okay? Let's try to make things happen. In other words, because very often I see issues pushed off for year after year after year. So pushing off is not always the best answer. Working with school to help the child or finding what will work. And then there's the whole issue of medication, okay? And parents are often very afraid of medication. So slides are ahead of me. So the ethics of medication, I think, is a very important issue, because I get these issues all the time. Is it ethical to medicate kids so they can fit into our system that we've created? And we have a system. Now, remember, ADHD is, people say, how come it didn't exist 200-300 years ago? How come we don't see evidence? Most disorders, we see evidence of them historically. How come we don't see evidence? Well, the truth is, it's a post-industrial revolution disorder. Okay? It's a disorder of going to school. It's a disorder of having to work and sit at a desk. Okay? These things did not exist 300-400 years ago. Okay? School was very minimal and ended by the time you were in, you were 10, 13. Okay? You weren't, and it didn't have this many hours and wouldn't have this much information that we had to know. We have a system that we ask kids to fit into. What are the risks of medicating versus not medicating? Okay? So let's talk about some of the risks of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. We have higher rates of antisocial and criminal behavior, higher rates of injuries and accidents, much higher rates of employment, marital difficulties, health problems, teen pregnancies, higher rates of children out of wedlock. The effects of ADHD on educational outcomes, right? Being the top 10% of the ADHD symptom distribution, as we said, it's about, Kyrus Kahn's basically having ADHD, doubles the probability of grade repetition, lowers math and reading scores by 8 to 10%. The effects of ADHD on child outcomes are much larger than the effects of physical health problems, such as asthma or even being in poor health, okay? ADHD has a huge effect academically. They tend to perform significantly less. They get less school, right? 2 to 3 years less on average. High dropout rates, very low college, graduation, and very low higher degree, postgraduate degrees. It's associated, this is just, again, more poor grades, increased use of school-based services, detention, expulsion, all the things we don't want to have in our kids happen at much higher rates with ADHD kids. Okay, the other risks are self-esteem and social functioning. Problems with self-esteem, social functioning persist well into adulthood. One study, really looked at the, at young adults and adult follow-ups, and those with ADHD scored much worse than controls at both times. Substance abuse. We just had a whole plenary on substance abuse, but ADHD and substance abuse is a huge issue. The bottom line is that untreated ADHD has, much higher rates, okay? Basically, you're twice as likely, right, to develop substance abuse if you have ADHD untreated, okay, as opposed to treated. Because what happens is if you actually treat ADHD, right, then the rates go down to practically normal, okay? The treating ADHD with medication reduced the risk of substance abuse, so it depends by 84%. So basically, you go from much higher rates with untreated ADHD to pretty much typical rates of substance and alcohol abuse in treated ADHD. And clearly it has, so more than 1,000 studies have demonstrated stimulants to be safe, effective, and the vast majority of properly diagnosed patients receiving them. Okay? It's gotten a lot of bad press, but the bottom line is it really saves lives. So in the ethics of medication, okay, the risks of medicating are short-term physical mild side effects, okay? Possibly a headache, stomach ache, and so forth. Okay? But the risk of not medicating, right? Poor school performance, alcohol substance abuse, marital problems, poor job performance, low self-esteem, there are some significant risks. Now, let's go on the whole ethics of expulsion. This is, an important question because I often get calls or have kids come in for evaluation when they get kicked out of school. So this is an issue I deal with all the time. Or I have kids who, eighth grade and can't get into a high school. So what criteria do we have? Who decides, right? And what are the responsibilities we have to the child? Okay? So we go back, first of all, to the Igros Moshe that we quoted before, right? Right? That if the child is being makalkel others, is causing others harm by being there, he's influencing them negatively, then we have reason to be concerned. The Chazon Ish, who's quoted, this was a whole article by his person who wrote his biography, wrote an article in Jewish Observer a number of years ago, and he talks about that it's better to put up with a problematic student and draw him as near as possible, right? And really, basically, you want to keep him in the yeshiva as long as possible. Okay, as we talked about before, you mean him makarev, that you push him and you pull him at the same time. But sending Bachram away from the yeshiva, he also is tantamount again to dina nefashos. Consider this is like deciding a capital crime, and he wasn't willing generally to push somebody out. And as much as, he gives one of the examples, this Rav came to him, that talking about how his experience was when the hardcore troublemakers left the yeshiva, the others improved greatly, and Chazon Ish says, experience doesn't overrule the Shulchan Aruch. You can't expel the student, you have to try and work with him. He had a very extreme view about it. Okay. I've had this case, kids caught stealing in school, right? So he told him, did you ever speak Lashon Hara? He says, did they throw you out of yeshiva as a result? What difference does it make what the Aveira was? So, you stole, you spoke Lashon Hara. They're all bad Aveiros. That doesn't mean for this one you have a right to, he's not Chayiv Misa. He's not Chayiv Misa, I can't kick him out. Okay? This was the Chazon Ish's approach. So, in other words, what are the criteria and how we deal with it? It's interesting because my son-in-law sent me a link to a blog of Orthodox principles who talk about this. And they talked about criteria, and the student's educational needs are beyond what the school is prepared or equipped to deal with. When the student's actions significantly impair the ability of other students to learn, or the teacher's ability to teach, and when the student presents a danger to other students, whether it be physical, psychological, or religious. So basically, I think criteria, are pretty agreed upon. The question of when the school can't supply a student's needs is a good one. But I think the criteria, when it's really dangerous to others, and the decision, and this is my big beef, and I don't know that others will necessarily agree with me, is that if I want to expel a student and I'm in charge of a school, I'm a nogei badavar. I can't paskin for myself. Okay, it's just like I can't paskin on my own chicken. I can't paskin certainly on a student. And therefore, I really think Rosh Yeshiva have to have someone they go to present and ask the shaila. And if they ask the shaila, I'd be fine with it. If they ask the shaila and the result is the student should be expelled, then we work with that. My experience, unfortunately, is that is rarely a shaila asked, okay? And I don't think it's advisable from a halachic, ethical approach that people take it upon themselves to make such decisions, okay? Because it really is, it's dinei nefashos. I know many kids, okay? We talk about kids off the derech. Most of the kids who go off the derech, they don't fit into the system, okay? And most of them because of ADHD and related issues. Okay, and I treat a number of kids who grew up in nice yeshivish homes, okay, who are now lawyers and MBAs, who couldn't handle the system. Not because they weren't smart enough. No, they're smart enough for law school, but they couldn't fit into the system. They couldn't sit still. They weren't the best kids. They were troublemakers. I don't doubt, that they were not a pleasure to have. But on the other hand, the system wasn't flexible enough to deal with them. Okay? So, in other words, what are our responsibilities? So I thought what was a beautiful story is Chazon Ish tells a story, there's a story told that one Rosh Hashiva came to him. And he says, his boy, he presented and he said, okay, I understand, you really have to expel this child. But you can't expel him yet. First, you have to start learning with him. After you've been learning with him for a few weeks, you can tell him that he has to leave the yeshiva, but you have to keep learning with him. Okay? Once you have this relationship and the student feels he's important to you, right, and you're going to continue learning with him until he finds someplace else to go, okay, then he's not going to feel totally rejected by the system. He's going to feel you care about him. Okay? And that's the only way you're allowed to do it. And the child ended up going to Chinuch himself and becoming a Rosh Yeshiva. So we have to begin, afterwards, then you could tell him, then you can notify him, be able to do in this framework. Okay. So in terms of this, okay, in terms of our whole responsibilities, I think it's important for us to recognize that they're broad. We have to be better at identifying. We have to be better at getting kids help when they need the help. We have to be concerned about the kids who really don't fit in and can't manage in the system. We have to understand that the kids aren't bad. Kids who behave badly are not bad kids. Okay? They're kids who really can't behave too well. And whether it's for emotional reasons or whether it's their ADHD or whatever the issues are, we have to work and help with that. Okay? And that parents have to be part of that process, recognize that it's a problem, work with it, try to get the help they need. Okay, so now we come to another issue, shidduchim. Okay? And shidduchim, the truth is that shidduchim is a huge issue when it comes to mental health. I have the privilege to talk to, prospective in-laws a few times a year generally, because I'm treating somebody and they're going for the shidduch and they want me to talk to the family doctor of the other side or the parents on the other side or the rav or somebody I have to talk to so they can find out what's going on with this person and check out that it's okay. The truth is now very often people often ask me, well, in other words, how long do I have to be on this? I have 8-year-olds where the parents are worried, are they going to be off medicine by the time they have to go for a shidduch? With the idea being, well, if they're not on medicine, then you don't have to say anything. So, and you know, there is, how relevant is this really to marriage? You know, is ADHD, you know, relevant? Is an issue I have to talk about. How relevant and how serious mental health issue is it? I mean, the good news, okay, is that it's not as serious an issue as a lot of other mental health issues, in large part because it's so treatable, okay? But, you know, it's the idea of hiding the issue, you know, to help a shidduch, or that if I'm not a medicine, I don't have to mention it, is common, okay? But the fact is that if it really impacts my interpersonal relations, as it often does, there's books about women, you know, the spouses, so there are books for spouses of people with ADHD, because it affects the relationship a lot. I always like telling the story of a guy who is, you know, on a date in a restaurant, and he's sitting across from a girl, and you know, he gets up, he, you know, he pays and leaves. The only problem was the girl was still sitting there. He just, at the moment, forgot. It's, you know, a lot of women will bring their husbands to me because they feel they can't have a conversation for 10 minutes. He's constantly getting up and he's checking on something, he's doing something, and they feel like he's not there. Okay? So, yes, it does impact the relationship. Okay? Now, it's, I have numerous rebbes, specific, you know, Hasidic rebbes who I know send people for medication, are very much in favor of it, feels it helps kids a lot, and they're consistent, because if you go for a shidduch and they say they're just on, you know, medication for ADHD, and I'll check nothing else, then they will be enough to say that's okay. They're not really concerned so much about the shidduch. The fact that they're actually being treated is, you know, makes them much more comfortable. But the reality is, starting marriage with deception is really not healthy for the relationship. And clients who treat the issue do well. So denying it is where we have problems. And as opposed to them coming in afterwards, it's really important that it be addressed. Yitzhak Berkowitz, who actually wrote a book about this, wrote an article also, which I have the, you know, things for it. And he talks about the halachos that apply here, those of not causing harm to another, which would require revealing if issues that could pose a threat to the future of the couple. And midvar sheker tirchak, that even when information can be withheld, you can't really lie outright about anything that in any way could be relevant. Okay. The other point he makes is that physical, psychological, and psychiatric conditions that could interfere with a person's ability to function properly as a spouse or parent, as well as any serious condition in the family that's hereditary, that information doesn't have to be revealed at an initial meeting, but you have the right to wait and see if this is a serious prospect before making oneself vulnerable. So basically, it's not something I have to tell every shotgun that everyone should know that this is my problem, but on the other hand, before things get too serious, it's certainly something that should be discussed. Okay, and generally, the nice thing with ADHD, so when it's been discussed, I've never had a situation where it started to shit off. I've had it with other disorders. I haven't, and it is quite hereditary. That is an issue for many people. But I have not had yet a situation where it started to shit off, because if a person is dealing with it, they can really function very well. Okay, it's something that is exceedingly treatable, and therefore, is really something we need to address. What you cannot do is conceal a serious condition, right, where the other person is emotionally involved, right, and then they're already, you're about to get engaged, and the day of the fort, you tell them, by the way, that's a little bit too late. But as he points out, it may be a strategic mistake to withhold even less critical information as the couple considers engagement, considering the fact that the other party could one day feel deceived. And that's what I'm saying. Starting out a relationship with deception is not a good way to go. And then he talks about the whole issue, if somebody else knows about it, their responsibility to say, Losan Val Dam Riecha, a whole other issue. We don't have time for right now. Okay, skip the next slide. Okay, so now, we'll get to number 3, the ethics of universal full-time based medrash. We started a little late, so I guess we'll go till about 5 to 3. Okay. And I think this is a very significant issue for the Orthodox community, because in large sectors of our community, the expectation is that guys are going to sit and learn till they get married and beyond. Okay. And, you know, many people, so that whereas in, you know, the YU community, guys might be starting, you know, go to Israel for a year or two and then go to college. In other, you know, sectors of the Orthodox community, the expectation is really they're going to sit and learn for much longer. You know, the question is the value or the risk of such a system that values Torah-only education, and what happens to the person who doesn't fit in. And the historical context for Universal Kollel, what happens to people who are first seeking employment at age 27 to 30 with no college degree, the financial stress and the stress on young women who have, you know, kids and jobs, etc. So this I found fascinating as I came across Rav Dessler and Richter Mayo, who talks about the difference between chinuch in Germany and chinuch in Poland and Lithuania. Where in Poland and Lithuania, they chose Torah only, right? And in Germany, they included secular education. And he shows that, in other words, whereas Rav Hirsch succeeded in producing lay people, almost uniformly observant, the attrition rate was very low. They didn't have lots of people going off the derech, but they didn't produce gedolim. In Eastern Europe, however, which had no secular studies, they produced many Torah giants, right? But they had a lot of dropouts. Okay. Now, what's interesting is his argument here, and arguments of others made, is that it was worth that it's to produce the gedolim. It's a risk worth taking. Okay. You know, the problem is if I can't sit still all day. Okay. What will make me feel part of the community? It's interesting because years ago I read Helmreich's book on the world of the yeshiva, and he discussed the variety of roles that people had in the yeshiva. You had a guy who was a shamish, and you had a guy who was the gabbai, and the guy who took care of the kiddushes, and the guy who helped out in the kiddush and did this. There were guys who just had different roles in the yeshiva. Not everybody was sitting in the base medrash all day long, right? In our system today, we've relegated all those jobs to others. Okay, yeshiva students no longer have a clean up or do this or set up and so forth. We have other people to hire to do that, and they're all expected to sit and learn. And it's created a situation that is much more narrow than it's ever been before. The historical context. For this, for yeshiva, I mean, the possible enrollment at the height in Europe was maybe up to 2,500 guys you had learning in yeshivas total at one time. It probably wasn't even close to that, but, that's about as high as it goes. Today, Mir Yerushalayim has 5,000. Volozhin, at its height in the late 1800s, they say it got up to 400 students in enrollment, which was the biggest yeshiva. So we're talking about numbers today that never existed before, okay? Right. And Rabbi Arya Carmel won't go into the whole discussion now. He talks about the whole issue of the Hirschian approach versus the Torah only approach, how do you choose? Right? How we view it, what's l'chachila and what's b'dievet, right? Because from a Torah and Derech Eretz approach, then learning secular studies is l'chachila, and from a Torah-only approach, it's clearly very much b'dievet. And in reality, he makes the argument that both models coexist in Torah, okay? And that if he pros through the Gemaras, through the Rambam, and so forth, that the Rambam really, really clearly shows both approaches. He talks about number one, the idea of that a person should learn Torah and yivnevayach achachisa isha, of doing things in a rational order, okay, And on the other hand, he talks about somebody who wants to dedicate himself to Torah, in other words, you know, Paschal Melech Tolchol of Bayim Suri Tishta, about really the more ascetic life approach. You know, that how one chooses is, you know, is really the question. And if we just skip down, I'm going to skip down a little bit. Yeah, so next slide. So the question is how we, you know, where we go, okay? What lifestyle we choose. And the fact is that what he points out is that if I'm not built for a lifestyle of Torah, right? You know, Abaye begged his students not to inherit two Gehenims. What do you mean? Because if they weren't really able to sit and learn the whole time, so then they're suffering in this world because they're trying to sit and learn and they're not making parnasa, and then they're going to suffer in Olam Haba because they didn't do what they were supposed to either way. You know, we have to really be honest and we have to be open with ourselves as well. And the idea of that, in other words, no one Torah ideal to the exclusion of the other, the idea that each one can be legitimate and adopting one versus the other, you know, I think is a concept that we all have to sort of learn how to embrace, because irrespective of what community you come from, we have to accept the fact that each child has to make a decision that works for them. And therefore, when we're talking especially about young adults with ADHD, okay, that, you know, if learning 10 to 12 hours a day is not an option, right, sitting in yeshiva and not being productive, is it really preferable just to be in a safe environment as opposed to growing in ways that a person can, right? We've never had so many people, I like to say all the time, that since Yisrael Tamei Yitzis Mitzrayim, when Moshe Rabbeinu ran the largest kolel in the Midbar, B'nai Yisrael has never had so many people sitting and learning in kolel as we have today. It was really for the elite in the past. And this universal approach is rather recent. So therefore, it's something we have to, I think, has to be reconsidered. Also, the whole issue of people trying to earn a living, people who are not planning to stay in learning forever, okay, who can't, right? When they start at 27, 28, 29 with no college degree, no training, and no family business to go into, there's a lot of resentment, and I see it in my practice. Okay, I have an office in Brooklyn, I have people come to me from Lakewood, I have them all over. They don't know where to turn, and I think the stress, in other words, that it caused on shalom bias issues for many of the, you know, young families, because, you know, the cost of living for firm couples escalates rapidly as their children get into school. So we have to really think about what the ethics are of the system that we've created. And is this a system that's really halachically ethical and appropriate for everybody? Or is it a system that we should say, okay, it's going to work, and it might work for 75% or 80%, but it's not for 100%, and we have alternatives. Not to say that we're willing to throw away 20 or 25% of the population because they don't fit the system. Okay. So I think these are issues that we need to look at, that we need to address. Okay, the system has to adapt to the needs of the broader community, and including those who can't fit into the system the way it has developed currently. And also, Rosh Yeshiva can't just push boys to stay, you know, and sit and learn with no concerns and thinking about their future. And there are many Rosh Yeshiva who are very cognizant of this, and unfortunately there are many Rosh Yeshiva, I think, who are not. So if we just to review the issues of the responsibilities of parents and principals of children with ADHD, we're talking about, you know, having responsibility in terms of identifying, in terms of treating, in terms of creating situations that work for students, okay? Parents recognizing getting students, our children, the help they need, and not kicking kids out just because they don't fit into our system. And if we do, make sure we have a place for them to go. Okay? The idea of expelling a student without having a place for them to go certainly doesn't make any sense. The idea in Shidduchim that hiding is generally not a good approach, okay, and generally not, as far as I'm concerned, totally unnecessary when it comes to ADHD, and just really bad for relationships. And then the whole question of the ethics of universal full-time based medrash for young adults, and you know, rethinking what the best approach would be. Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you so much, Dr. Holzer. That was an enlightening lecture. If you could please talk for a minute about the correlations that we have now. You mentioned medication and the risks of not being medicated, but there have been some, you know, a lot of attention given to the studies that show a link to certain medications, stimulants that are for ADHD, and higher risks of suicide and depression. And if those studies are done by independent medical, even the studies you mentioned before of safety with those medications, if they're done by the drug companies themselves supervised, or are they done by independent medical?
Yeah, the studies on with stimulants are, we have a lot of good long-term multi-center studies that have been done at places like Pittsburgh and Columbia, and this, there are six different sites at once. You have a lot of good long-term studies. The question of, let's say, increased depression, there are people who can get depressed from stimulants. It's usually an immediate response, something that you pick up right away. It's not a long-term something that develops. It's something that actually you pick up very quickly in terms of a side effect. Usually comes if they're over-medicated, but you'll have some people who really can't tolerate, a very small percent. But the risks of medication, if you read the studies and not the blogs, the studies are really impressive. And the bottom line is that even though, yes, there are a lot of studies that are funded by drug companies, there are also a lot of studies out there that are funded by NIMH. And if you read the good studies, there is no real comparison. I mean, as much as I don't believe that medication is the answer, okay, I certainly believe that medication is part of the solution, and being afraid of it is not necessarily the way to go. Okay, and avoiding identifying because of medication is certainly not the way. Yes?
Are children weaned off the medications, or do they stay on it for life?
Children, every person is an individual, and each child that takes the medicine only as long as they need to take it. Okay, it really is an individual question. Some kids stay on it for a couple of years, some kids stay on it for a long time. I have no way to answer that question.
How's it determined? How long?
By the needs. By the symptoms, right. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.